Welcome to the Andy Stanley Leadership Podcast, a conversation designed to help leaders go further faster. Today, we're talking about the role of systems in your organization. First, we'll listen to a portion of one of Andy's talks entitled, Liberating Your Organization. Afterwards, Andy will spend some time with us unpacking this idea a little further.
As you think about your systems, I want to give you four things that I just think you've got to blend in. And if these are not part of your system, here's some conversation points for you during this conference or when you get home. Here are things that if these are not part of your system, I just think you got to do whatever it takes to get them there because this is going to allow you to go further faster. Letter A, your system should allow you to involve and hire the best person for the job. Your system should allow you to hire and involve the best person for the job. In our Constitution, the opening line of our Constitution says this, the people we use is more important than the system we choose. The people we use is more important than the system we choose. Or choose, you can flop, swap, choose, and use. Because if you get great people, great things happen. If you don't have great people, great things just aren't going to happen. You need a system that allows you to hire the best and the brightest. As I've talked to my friends in Methodist and Presbyterian Church specifically, you know what I discovered? Their churches would not even, let me put it this way. Because of education and because of background, their churches would not even be allowed to hire most of the people who work at this church, including me, because the system wouldn't allow it. If you have a system that doesn't allow you to hire the best and the brightest, you have a systems problem. You have automatically put a lid on what can happen in your organization. I wrote this, if you are forced to hire based on education and where a person was educated versus talent and competency, you have a systems problem. In our church, we do not use the term pastor. People ask all the time, well, how many pastors do you have? I say, I don't know. We don't use that term. That terminology in our environment is really irrelevant. I think pastoring is a gift, absolutely. But in terms of a title, we just don't use that because it's just not relevant. We want to hire the very best people who are competent, obviously, who love God and have character. I mean, that's a given. We want to hire the very best people to do the job. You need a system that allows you to get the very best people to do the most important jobs. Letter B, your system should provide you with the flexibility to get the right people to the table. You need a system that gives you the flexibility to get the right people to the table. That means when you're making critical decisions about an issue, you need to be able to get the smartest, most well-informed people in your organization to the table to help you make that decision. Let me just read you a couple things I wrote here. Never give people a seat at the decision-making table based on organizational responsibility alone. This is huge. You don't give people a seat at the decision-making table based on organizational responsibility alone. Here's what I mean by that. And let me give you an example. In our organization, there's a guy on our staff named Bill Willits who's been with us from the very beginning. Bill is an incredible leader. He's an incredible manager. He's creative. I mean, he goes on and on and on. Right now, Bill oversees all of our group stuff. When Bill started, he had a different job. Now, as the organization changed, I knew I want Bill Willits sitting at the table with me. I don't care what his responsibility is here. I don't care if he's the student pastor or the youth or doing children or it doesn't matter. I'm not going to put somebody who's necessarily has a position. In other words, just because somebody's this, for example, Bill does groups now. If Bill went off and decided to do something else in the organization, I would keep Bill at the table with me, but I would not necessarily put the next group director at the table with me. Because I want the people at the table with me who are the best to help make decisions, not based on the responsibility. Now, again, you come out of environments, I understand it. I grew up in one in the Baptist church. It was the pastor, it was the music director, and the education director. It didn't matter how competent they were, smart they were, godly they were, what kind of decision makers they were. It didn't matter. If you're the pastor, the education guy, or the music guy, you were the top three guy, and then maybe a business guy. And whoever had those roles sat at the table. Bad system. You need a system that allows you to get who you need at the table helping you make decisions regardless of their responsibility in the organization. And at North Point, we have swapped that around so many times because I just know that it's a principle. I want the best and the brightest helping me make the most important decisions. And just because somebody has a role in the organization doesn't necessarily mean they get a seat at the table. And a hush fell over the crowd. It's kind of different, isn't it? When you're making a financial decision, you need to be able to round up the smartest financial minds you know. Listen, if you have elders at your church and they're great elders, but they're not real smart or the smartest guys in the church when it comes to finances, don't make a financial decision, a big financial decision, just based on the input of the elders if they're not the most keen financial minds in the church. That's not smart. That's not godly. You go, yeah, but God's chosen the elders. I know. I'm all for elders. We have elders. They could meet while this is going on and fire me today, and there would be no recourse. I believe in accountability. But you know what else I believe in? Just because somebody is a great discerning elder does not mean they're necessarily the sharpest financial mind. And the sharpest financial mind may not have what it takes to be an elder. But I don't want a system that straps me into having to depend on men and women who aren't necessarily all that sharp financially to make financial decisions. That's just not smart. You have to have in your system the flexibility to get the right people to the table to make the most important decisions. That is a systems issue. Letter C, your system should allow you to make complex decisions within the context of a small group of empowered individuals. I mean, so here's what I wrote about that. This principle, this is where your business meetings and your church just get totally screwy, okay? Some of you have lost your job because of violation of this principle. Here's what I mean by that. Let me just read it to you. You cannot effectively communicate complicated information to a lot of people. It's impossible. This is just a principle. You cannot effectively communicate complicated information to a whole lot of people. If you want to communicate complicated information, you're trying to buy land, you're trying to, you know, come up with a campaign to raise money, you're trying to make staffing decisions, you need a small group of completely informed, empowered people to make those decisions. You got to have that. That's a systems issue. The problem with congregational rule when you're trying to make complicated decisions is you cannot effectively communicate all the intricacies that a person needs to understand to make the decision, and then you vote. And you know how that works? The person with the microphone wins. The person that's the most persuasive wins in spite of the facts, in spite of the details. I tell you, I think we'll see a great example of this. Most recently, like, you know, a few days ago, a national Christian leader fell morally. And within 2 days, the leaders of that church met, looked at the evidence, and said, he's out. That's a good system. They didn't have to have a business meeting. They didn't have to have a congregational meeting. They didn't have to have 2 weeks of trying and, oh, whoa, whoa, whoa. I don't know anything about that church. But I thought when I read that, I thought there's a system that was in place that when there was a tragedy, the smart people stepped up, made a very tough decision and made it, and they're moving on. That's a good system. You need a system where a complex decisions can be made within the context of a small group of empowered people. I would say 8 to 10 people, but that's up to you. Letter D. Your system should ensure that only one person answers to they. You need a system where only one person answers to they. Nobody wants to answer to they. But in a good organization, at least one person has got to answer to they. In our organization, it's me. I answer to the elders. I'm responsible to the elders. I work for a group, but nobody else in our organization works for a group. Everybody else has a single point person boss. No, some of you are in situations where you have a boss, but then there's a committee you answer to, and you know how frustrating it is to answer to a they. Some of you are in systems where the elder can bypass the senior pastor and go down and deal with the youth pastor or go over and work with the children's director. You know how frustrating that is. You need a system where only one person answers to they. And if you're the senior pastor, it's probably you. There's got to be one person. And this is kind of a current trend that I just kind of, you know, cringe when I think about. Part of the trend is for church planners to have no they. It's just them. Just them and their wife. You know, just them and their best friend. Bad system. Somebody's got to answer to they in a great system. Only one person answers to they. It's kind of the CEO model, and it's worked for corporations all over America. But I don't think they made it up. I think it's biblical. It's why the Bible talks about elders. It's why, you know, God sent prophets to talk to the king. We can talk more about that later.
Well, Andy, the first thing you ask your audience to do is create a system that allows them to hire the best person for the job. Once those systems are in place, there's still the difficult task of matching the right person with the right position.
Right.
Will you talk a minute about the systems North Point uses to ensure the right people are hired for the right position?
Yeah, that's really important because it's one thing to get the right, to get, you know, competent people in the room for the interview, but then if you don't have systems in place, you don't necessarily make a good match. And For small organizations, this is really difficult because generally there aren't systems in place for hiring people. There's just an interview process. And an interview is not necessarily a system because you can have bad interviews. In the early days, I interviewed everybody. And Diane, my assistant, finally told me, Andy, you should not play this role in the organization. And I said, why? She said, because you talk too much. She said, it's like you're trying to sell them on the organization. They're already sold on the organization. So I learned very quickly, we need to put systems in place. Otherwise, interviewing becomes very personality-driven and personality-centered, and that's not a good way to go. So some of the things that we've put in systematically to help us make good choices, number one, are really well thought through job descriptions. In church world, oftentimes it's, you know, we're looking for a student pastor, we're looking for a children's director, as if that's a job description. And that's not, that's simply a role or a title. So a very, very specific job description. The more specific the job description, the easier it is for candidates to self-select themselves out of an opportunity, and the easier it is for people who are interviewing to ask helpful questions. So number one, really specific job interview description. The second thing is we do multiple interviews. The average person we hire is interviewed either from 5 to 8 different times by 5 to 8 different people, and a top-level executive position in our organization, 12 interviews. And in addition to multiple interviews, it's cross-departmental, where somebody in our family ministry would be interviewed by somebody in the service programming division or from my my area. So multiple interviews, that's systematic. Everybody knows how many hoops they have to jump through. Cross-departmental interviews, very, very specific job descriptions. And when we hire people, they generally say the process was brutal. We've had people say, I almost just gave up because the process was about to kill me. And I thought, if it's this hard to get hired, I'm not sure I even want to work here. But again, those are things that we have implemented systematically. It takes the personality out of it. It certainly takes me out of the loop. In fact, Diane, my assistant, does a lot of interviewing. I generally meet people after they've almost been hired. I'm like the last person in the string of events because, again, that's just not my skill set.
Well, and one of the things I've heard you say before and that I know that we think about when we're hiring is we want this not only to be a great fit for our organization, but we also want this to be a great fit for the person we're hiring.
Yeah, and in fact, we say that. In fact, I don't know who created that question or that statement in our system, but I love it. And we say that. We say we're not only going to try to make sure you're the right fit for us, we want you to love this job. We want this to feel like a calling. We want this to be a passion. And as you look at the specifics on this job description, is this something you could wake up every day excited about? Because we want you to be as thrilled about us as we are about you. One of the other things we do that's just part of our systems is we test candidates. In fact, we have 3 different tests that we use. We don't give everybody all 3 tests, but we can use up to 3 tests. Again, these are very time-consuming. They're somewhat expensive for us. But again, that's just a built-in part of the system. Nobody gets hired without taking the Taylor Johnson test. Nobody gets hired without doing Right Path. And then there's some very, very skill-specific tests that we'll give depending on the department. Again, this says to the candidate, we're taking this very, very seriously. And again, testing takes the emotional part and sort of the personality part out of the mix because, as you know, Evan, you meet somebody that you like a lot. You think, gosh, I would love for them to work here. But there are things that you're not going to discover about them until it's too late unless you bring some objectivity into the process. So part of our systems are, no matter how much we love you, no matter what you accomplished at your last organization, you still have to take, in some cases, a battery of tests before we move along in the process.
One of the things you mentioned in the talk, Andy, was that you said that leaders should not give people a seat at the decision-making table based on organizational position alone. What would you say to a leader who has inherited a system that automatically puts people with certain titles at the decision-making table?
Yeah, that's really tough. And most people in church and in ministry, even in nonprofit, they come into a system. They don't get to create it. There's already a hierarchy. As I mentioned in the talk, there's already the music director and the pastor and the education director or however it works in their denomination. So here's what you got to do. Instead of trying to move those people out, which is generally a way to get yourself moved out in most churches, what you have to do is create a way to get other people in. So assuming I've got 3 people that I have to meet with because this is the board or this is the committee and they're immovable, they've been there forever, they're the founders, you know, however it works. The key is to create a conversational environment where you may have to include those three people, but to create a conversation where you can get other voices in. So you reach down in the organization and you think, who's the sharpest person? Who's the smartest person? Again, as I mentioned, if it's a financial decision, who's the sharpest person financially? And in some cases, in some organizations, you have to create a separate meeting. This might not be the official meeting, the official board meeting, the official management meeting, but I'm gonna have a get-together, whatever they have to call it, include those three people so they don't feel left out, but then invite the other people in the organization that whose voices you need to hear and allow those other three people to hear those voices with you. So the answer to the question is you have to create another layer, or maybe not a layer, but another meeting or conversation in the organization where those voices can be heard, but where the people that are entrenched in the organization can be included in the conversation as well. And then later on, which inevitably happens when, you know, the doors are closed and that they are meeting behind the closed doors, that's when the leader says, you know what, let's remember what we learned in the other meeting. Let's don't filter out that extra information. And over time, if a leader's really leveraging their gift properly, over time, they will learn within the rhythm of their organization how to include those other voices. And hopefully, if those other voices bring great content or new insight or fresh insight into the conversation, maybe things begin to loosen up a bit and they can begin to expand that circle of influence in their organization. But they have to, you know, the key is they have to begin with where things are, but instead of removing people or taking people away from the table, adding other people too. And then hopefully over time, things can become more interchangeable.
As you talk about making these complex decisions with smaller teams, what are some specific examples of ways that North Point allows complex decisions to be made in these small groups of empowered individuals?
Yeah, I don't know that I was that clear in the talk about that. I kind of rushed through that. But the principle being you can't explain complicated information with lots of people in the room. The more complex the information, the smaller the group has to be. So here's what we've done at North Point, and we did this from the very beginning, and I love this system. I work with three decision-making bodies. We have a staff leadership team that oversee primarily programming. I have a stewardship team that their sole responsibility is to view what we do as an organization through the lens of finances. That's their sole charge. And then a group of elders that are very, very mature believers who are very discerning. That's kind of the preeminent thing about being an elder here, is not that they're in a leadership role, though they may be, but that they're just discerning individuals. So these are the three decision-making bodies. So for me, depending on the nature of the decision, I begin the conversation with the group that I feel it's most appropriate to begin that conversation with. And I make decisions within the context of one of those three small groups based on, you know, the nature of the decision. Then, in some cases, I might have to have that conversation with two groups. I may run something through the filter of the staff, then run it through the filter of the stewardship team. In some cases, I need to just run it through the filter of the staff, and maybe it's just a programming decision. But the mistake would be, which is, I see this sometimes in organizational life, the mistake would be to say, well, instead of having three groups and managing three sets of relationships, why don't I just put them all together and just have one big meeting with 25 or 30 people? Well, as soon as I do that, I violated the principle that you can't really have a conversation about complicated issues with a large group of people. So by having three different smaller groups, I'm able to have real genuine conversations, dig out the information I need without, again, having, you know, two or three rows of people in a conversation. I grew up in a system where we had 50 to 60 to 70 deacons. And we would have deacons' meetings, but they weren't meetings. They were just monologues, because you can't have an interactive meeting with 50 or 60 or 70 people in the room. And you certainly can't cover in detail very complex information. And in church world, many of the decisions we make are very, very complex. They deal with lots of money. They deal with personalities. You're dealing with salaries. You're dealing with complex programming, initiatives, all these things. And a leader needs to be able to get the smartest people he can find in a room around the table to make those decisions. So whatever the system looks like, it just needs to enable the leader to do that. There have been occasions, Evan, when I feel like I need to have a conversation about a specific issue with all three groups, and that's very rare. An example would be when we decided to go multi-campus. You know, that was not a casual decision. That was a staffing, that was going to impact staffing, that was going to impact us financially, and that was sort of a variation from our original vision or charter as a church. So that was a conversation I had with all three groups. But when there was buy-in or consensus from all three of those small conversation-sized groups, I felt like we knew what to do, and I think we all moved with confidence knowing that this is the direction the organization needs to take.
And you are talking about, in that instance, a very complex decision that impacted a lot of lives.
It impacted everybody, yeah. And how? And I look back, it would have been so difficult. In fact, it would have been impossible to have that conversation with 40 different personalities and view, you know, or to have a congregational meeting. Say, okay, church, let me explain this to several thousand people. You just can't do that effectively.
But this is a great question or a great point is when you make a complex decision like this, how do you communicate it in such a way that people feel ownership of what in this case was a potentially large change in their life?
Yeah, that's a great question. And ownership is the key. You want people not to simply hear that a decision has been made. We want people to own the decision. So in general, kind of backing up a little bit, in general, I think, and this isn't my idea, I learned this from other people, decisions need to be made, and I don't like this terminology, but I don't know any other way to say it. Decisions generally need to be made at the lowest level in the organization. And I don't mean low like lowly. I mean, you know, there's point leadership, and then there's a leadership team, and, you know, every organization has layers. So every decision, or decisions in general, need to be made at the lowest level in the organization. The reason that's true is you never want to make a decision, if it's possible, that impacts somebody without that somebody being able to weigh in on the decision. Nobody likes the day when somebody walks in their office and says, there's been a meeting, you weren't invited, a decision's been made, and your future has been impacted by that decision, or your ministry, or your program, or your budget has been impacted. So whenever possible, good leaders involve the people who are impacted in the decision. Or maybe not in the decision, but in a discussion that will ultimately lead to a decision. So in terms of the communication of these kinds of decisions, we think of it in terms of concentric circles. You know, in terms of the big circle, who are the people that ultimately are going to be impacted? Is there any way to involve them, and this is a key, is there any way to involve them in a conversation about the options without empowering them to make a decision? And this is huge. In other words, can I have a conversation with a group of people who are going to be impacted? The goal of the conversation is not to make a decision. The goal of the conversation is to let them know these things are being discussed. Here are some of the options. What do you think? Because generally speaking, if a person feels like they've been heard, then they can go with a decision that doesn't go their way as long as they feel like somebody represented them at the table. So when I meet with the broadest group of leaders or our ministry team representatives who kind of function like deacons in a way, they represent the different areas of ministry. When I meet with that group and say, I'd like your input on a subject, we're not making a decision tonight, but I want to leave here with everybody's cards on the table. I want to leave here with your collective insight. And then I go back and then we kind of move that up the chain and smaller groups have those discussions. When I come back to that broader circle and say, here's the decision that's been made, at least there's a feeling amongst that group that my voice was heard, my ideas were considered. In some cases, the decision that was made reflects ideas from that initial group. So, big picture, you want to push the decision as far down into the organization as you can, and you want to begin the discussions about the options being considered as far down in the organization as you can, and then ultimately make the decision, again, as far down in the organization as possible.
Andy, can you give me a specific example of that?
We're in the process of reevaluating our entire budget right now. And so here's several approaches. One approach is I could take the budget, go in my office, decide what I like, what I don't like, what's working, what's not working, get my red pen out, show up at the management team meeting and say, here's our new budget. And there wouldn't be much recourse. I mean, they could do an end run and go talk to the elders, but they probably wouldn't do that. So that's one approach. And my insights may be exactly right, but there would be a price to pay. Second option is to sit down with the management team, sort of the next circle, give them a copy of the budget, give everybody in the room a red pen and say, before we leave this meeting, we're cutting X percent from the budget. Okay? At least that group would have buy-in because they were in the room. But then there's three or four more levels in the organization that would be extremely frustrated. So what we did, and you were there, we had a staff meeting with everybody from all three campuses, said, we need to cut X percent from the budget. You go find it. Go find it in your department. Look for things we can do cross-departmentally. Send those ideas to me. Send those ideas to our campus pastors. Well, we got dozens and dozens of ideas. Many of them were very, very good. Many of them will be implemented. And the decision about what we do with our budget will not be made in a group of people, you know, with the whole staff in the room. The decision will be made with a smaller group who can disseminate and work through all that detailed information. But hopefully everybody on our staff feels like they had a voice in the conversation and they were heard. So again, the decision's made in a small group where you can have the conversation, but you hopefully begin the conversation in the biggest circle, the broadest circle possible.
Which is ensuring ownership, buy-in, back to the immediate point of vision.
That's the goal anyway.
Sure.
There's
sure.
always going right. to be an outlier. But right. at least people generally feel like I had an opportunity to be heard. I had an opportunity to send my email with my idea, and hopefully it got to the conversation where the decision was made.
Andy, one of the other things that you mentioned in the clip is you talked about only having one person to report to and everyone else having a single voice to report to. How do you keep a system like that from negatively impacting communication and community within the organization?
Well, this goes back a little bit to the previous question. In every organization, it's important to differentiate between lines of authority and lines of communication. In a traditional organization, the lines of authority are the lines of communication. That is, the guy or the man or woman at the top, they talk to the person that reports to them, and they talk to the person that reports to them, and so everything is communicated up and down the lines of authority. In a healthy organization, the lines of authority are bold and clear. The lines of communication are dotted, and they go everywhere. In a healthy organization, everybody should have permission and feel the freedom to talk to anybody. In an unhealthy organization, most people are afraid to talk to anyone other than people that work specifically for them or that they answer to. The last thing they want to do is walk out of an office with three or four people in the office, and there stands their boss staring at them with this look of, what were you talking about? What were you meeting about? And so from the very beginning, we've created a culture where hopefully people feel the freedom to talk to anyone at any time about anything. In fact, twice in our history, there have been very, very sensitive personnel issues that came up, and I began to sense that there was whispering, like, oh, we can't talk about this out loud. In one case, it was a high-level person that left, and I knew that they were probably going to talk to two or three employees about leaving here with them to go work in a different organization, which actually was fine with me. When we do our new employee orientation, I tell people, you're not going to work here forever. I don't want this to be your only job. I just want this to be the best job you've ever had. So I kind of sensed this, you know, can we talk about this? So I got up in front of the staff and I said, you know what? We don't have to whisper about this. If someone comes to you and wants to hire you, you don't have to, you know, close the door and lock the door and whisper. We just don't have to operate that way. Now, that's a little bit of an aside, but the point is, in a healthy organization, you want there to be the freedom for anyone to talk to anyone. Now, as the point leader, I do that all the time. I skip over my direct reports and go deeper into the organization, generally speaking, because I want information quicker than having to wait for people to meet with people. But in a fast-paced organization, in a nimble organization, you have to have that kind of communication. So what a leader has to do is make sure that the lines of authority are very, very clear and that certain decisions, in fact, most decisions have to be made within the chain of authority. But conversations, that's a whole different thing, and they can happen anywhere. So that's how, going back to your question, that's how you, again, create an organization that you can identify on paper, but at the same time, create community within that organization that's not tied to a line of or a chain of authority.
And Andy, you talk about the creating community, and it seems like a lot in our world that instead of creating community, what we oftentimes do is create committee. And so we have...
In our church world.
What do you say to the church leader who works in a system where decisions are made by multiple committees?
Yeah. I grew up in a denomination where that's prevalent. And I understand why it's prevalent in most small churches, because in most small churches, there is a pastor and there might be a music director. And either one of those two guys, men or women, may be there 3 or 4 years, then they're gone. So the mainstay of the average local church is not the staff. It's the members. It's the people who grew up in and own and love that community. So consequently, since those people have real jobs and real lives, the only way for the church to function is through a group, a list, or really a group of committees, because those committees are there forever where the staff comes and goes. But that does create a very, very difficult dynamic for the man or the woman who is hired into a church and comes there not only to communicate, but specifically to lead. So for the man or the woman who has been hired into a church that is run by committee, they have to make two decisions. Number one, how long do I plan to stay here? If they think, you know, this is a 3-year stay for me, this is a 4-year stay, this is a stepping stone, I don't think I want to stay here and raise my family in this community, then the last thing they need to do is dismantle a system of committees that actually works for that local church. Because once they're gone, if they've dismantled those committees, they've essentially dismantled the leadership. So that's the first decision. If they decide, I'm going to stay, that this is where I want to stay, I'm going to dig in, I'm going to commit my life and put the weight of my leadership behind making this a great church, then they need to come up with a plan that slowly weans the dependency of the church off committees onto a more staff-centered leadership model, if the church can, again, afford staff. But even a church that is small and only has a handful of staff can be staff-led, but it's a process for committees to learn to let go of their authority, to lean hard in the leadership to the leadership skills of the pastor and ultimately the staff. But that's a process. But I would just say to the average church leader, before you begin dismantling the committee system, although the committee system is not the most efficient system, before you do that, you need to understand why it's there, why it might be healthy for a church, and how long do you plan to stay.
Andy, to wrap it up, what is the key takeaway you would offer to organization or department leaders about systems?
Wow. I think it goes back to sort of the theme of this whole talk when I originally did it, and that's that systems create behaviors. They just do. And so I ask myself this question all the time. I ask our team this question all the time. I think it's a question that leaders need to ask all the time, and it's, what are the behaviors in my organization I want to reinforce, and what are the behaviors I would like to see go away? What are the behaviors among staff and among our organization that I want to reinforce, and then what can I do systematically to reinforce those behaviors? What are the behaviors I would like to see go away? And before I start calling people to my office and say, quit acting that way, and why do you do that, and why do you respond that way, look in the mirror and say, what are the systems that are in place that are reinforcing these behaviors that I wish would go away? Because at the end of the day, in organizational life, it's systems that create and maintain and fuel behaviors.
Andy, that was great. Thanks for your time. I look forward to next month's conversation.
Thanks, Evan.
Thank you for listening to the Andy Stanley Leadership Podcast. For more information, please visit us at northpoint.org. Also, visit northpointresources.org to purchase the Systems DVD, as well as other leadership resources from Andy Stanley.